be a meal on Earth, you know. And Whitman had a gift. He had the same personality that Emerson had. And I don't know that anyone in here has mentioned it, and I know I haven't this whole time. Whitman has a magnetic personality. It's so strong, it's so attractive, that people have to get away from him. So as not to be pulled into his orbit. Now you feel that indirectly through me. You see, I can still, this far away from Emerson, I can still, through Emerson, exert a sort of attractiveness, attraction, that will pull you. I see that comes through Emerson. It's not me. I don't attract anybody. I used to think I read Emerson when I was back in school, and I read these notes where he went barnstorming. See, like Mark Twain going on lecture tours. People did that then. Thoreau made lectures, gave lectures. I suppose they all did. At the Chautauqua, the Lyceum, I think they called it. He went out through the Middle West and talked, to the country people or the townspeople, anybody that'd come, they'd fill up the courthouse. And he'd read them one of these essays, and you think now, my mind wanders when I read it, what did they do when they heard it? But you see, there's no question about that. I wondered about that. How out in this, they not only were uneducated, but they were against education. All through the 19th century, they resisted it. We've been inundated with it. It's hard to say. It's hard to conceive. It's hard to realize. But it was that attraction that Emerson had. I don't know. I feel that they must have got something, and something worth getting. Maybe the essentials. Don't you know? You don't trust yourselves. You won't let yourself go. I don't think a soul in here has any more than mentioned this election sermon. Unless you've got a logical approach, something like the Ten Commandments, you stay away from it. And you see what Hawthorne, and I do the same thing. I don't know why I read your papers. I think that's it. I get in a vindictive frame of mind when I read papers. You can see how it works. But see, there are no words in this. It's just sound. But it's cadences, you see, that he hears. And it's almost like Whitman. It's almost like Emerson, you see, in those courthouses out in the Middle West. All those, they're not country people quite yet in his time. When he's out there, they're more like on the frontier. People with great vigor. Somewhere along the line, they settle down into housekeepers, husbandmen. And that's what Thoreau seems to be allergic to, that process of settling down. Now, look at that. I don't know anything that's any better than this and that. Now, I'll tell you what let's do. I want to read this one little thing with you. You can read this. Read it like I read it to you. You see, you don't read this. Let me show you the difference. That drum tap saying. I didn't have the page of it last time. I don't know whether you found it or not. Well, I guess you found drum taps. Now, this is the one that's put in the, you know, in the Reader's Anthology school book. Drum taps. What page is that? There's one that says beat, beat, drum. I want you to look at it. But mostly, you see, what Whitman writes, you don't look at it, you hear it. Now, you know, it's very small things that can just turn you upside down. And the only thing is, you don't realize it when you've been turned upside down. One of the things that turned me upside down, I haven't told you about that, I won't go into it, but I heard a boy, a man, who had been in the South Pacific in World War II, bring back some ballads, and he recited those, and he got more out of those things than I realized was in them. That changed my whole outlook towards things. Now, let's freshmen read a poem. I can't stand it, the way freshmen read poems. So I wouldn't venture to do that. I wouldn't offer to do it. And in high school, they read poems. They read Whitman. But they don't read Whitman. You see, beat, beat drums, blow, bugles, blow, through the windows, through doors, burst like a ruthless force into the solemn church and scatter the congregation. I don't know how you'd read that, through the windows, through doors, and burst through the ruthless force into the solemn church. There's not much rhythm in it. He don't need rhythm because there's so much feeling in it. Now you look. Drums, if you hear a drum, it'll hold you. We were camped out, we went to camp out in that big desert up above Karachi. Just flat for miles. And I remember one night, we'd been there several weeks waiting for orders, and I was out there, and I heard these drums. I said, I'll just walk over there. And I started out, just lit out across the desert. And I followed those drums for I don't know how long. I'd think it'd be time to get close to them. I never got there. And all the time I heard those drums, I could picture what was going on in that little island in the night, so to speak. So the drums, sometimes you see more than a whole symphony, a whole mind. And that's what he's saying here now. Beat, beat drums. And blow, bugles, blow. Through the windows, through the doors, and burst like a ruthless force into the solemn church and scatter the congregation into the school where the scholar is studying, and leave not the bridegroom quiet. No happiness must he have now with his bride, nor the peaceful farmer any peace, plowing his fields or gathering his grain, so fierce you were, and pound you drums, beat, beat drums, over the traffic of cities, over the rumble of wheels in the streets, our beds prepared for the sleepers at night in the houses. No sleepers, this is sarcastic. This is all a sort of a recitative, like he heard in the opera. No sleepers must sleep in those beds. This little sarcastic in his recitative. No bargainers bargain by day, no brokers or speculators. Would they continue? Would the talkers be talking? Would the singer attempt to sing? Would the lawyer rise in the court to state his case before the judge? Then rattle quicker, heavier drum. Drums. Make no parley. Stop for no expostulation. Mind not the timid, mind not the weeper or prayer. Mind not the old man beseeching the young man. Let not the child's voice be heard, nor the mother's entreaties. Make even the trestles to shake the dead where they lie, awaiting the hearses, so strong you thump. Now that's the way these little war poems go. They're so simple. And they're so full. And then you say, why did Ishmael go to sea? To withdraw. To find time. He went. Oh my, you see, Whitman is the one who tells you those things. Now you see, he sees more in the war than the soldiers saw. He feels more. Anybody alive today who can do this. So if you want to feel lighthearted, now look at that, afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road, healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. I think that was, this little simple line was as far beyond Emerson, he couldn't touch it. But he leads in this direction. You know, you talk about being footloose and free, and if you, you got no words for it, you know. And if you were, you, I don't know how, what you do, what I do. And here it is. You see, here it is, the song of the open road. Wordsworth liked an open road. But he's heavy when he writes about it. He's an old clodhopper, long legs and big feet, and he was out on the roads all his life. And he puts it a little bit into his poems, you see, but his art has not reached a point where he can get the road in his poems. Now you look in these English surveys and English writers and Wordsworth, and they can't get the open road into their poems. No matter how much skill they have, Keats, all his little young skill, he can't do it. And look at Whitman. Whitman got no skill. He doesn't know how to write. Well, he's just as ignorant as he can be. Now I'll show you how ignorant he is in this song myself. You'll see it. I don't have to show it to you. Henceforth I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth I whimper no more. Postpone no more, need nothing. Done with indoor complaints, libraries, querulous criticisms. Strong and content, I travel the open road. Now you see, that's... Now let me tell you. You could come in here, beginning of the term, and I could read you this, and I could say the same thing I say to you now, and it would leave you perfectly flat. I don't know, there has to be that long preparation. your contrast to Franklin. And then Walden, where you try to struggle, you see, to sort of get into the spirit of it, and you're always pulling against him, or you feel like he's hacking away at you, and you're fighting him. And Emerson, you know what you do in Emerson, you read the book on Emerson and say he was a transcendentalist. And so you never feel Emerson. You read the book. Now you see, I kept you from reading the book, and I've kept you into Emerson just a little bit. I still think in the Scarlet Letter you're struggling with that sin and guilt business, and that's not in it. I don't know why it is. The mind is a curious thing. It just simply can't, I don't know. Just a curious thing. Curious thing. I see there's no sin and guilt in this. You say the book says that Whitman is an affirmer, that Emerson is an affirmer, not a naysayer. But it's hard to affirm. Boy, it's hard. Well, you know what they do if you went down to Sunday school or to your Chamber of Commerce or wherever you go or will go, and you read a little poem like this, you think you get away with it? No, those strong-minded men would say, what the hell are you reading that for? Those strong-minded men who are possessed with logic and consistency, and that hard perseverance that we associate with Franklin, and I'm not sure that it's there, never say quits. Now, I don't know what they say. They might like it. But I've had members of my classes. I've read Emerson classes off and on. And I've had diehards in here your age. Yes, sir. I could just see them sit through the class, just hard knots of resistance. No, sir. No, sir. I ain't going to have any of this old Whitman stuff. You see, there's so many irrelevancies a man can get off on. We can say that Whitman is irreverent, and that he talks immodestly about sex. Now, Robert Louis Stevenson didn't put sex into his novels. He says he's not against it, but that destroys the novel. It's so strong, so powerful. Now, what Whitman has ideas, and he has all sorts of frightful ideas. Now, look, the earth, that is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them. I see, you can read this and just get just about all of Whitman you need. But for academic purposes, you've got to take on a little more. I swear it is impossible for me to get rid of them. You road I enter upon and look around. I believe you are not all that is here. I believe that much unseen is also here. That much unseen is also here. Now watch. This is the unseen. Hear the profound lesson of reception. Now, Whitman makes a mistake of using words of his own choice, so you don't know what he means by reception. Now, what do you take from the context he means by reception? Reception. What does he mean? Nor preference, nor denial. Out on the open road, there's no preference, no denial. The black with its woolly head, the sullen, the diseased, the illiterate person are not denied. The burst, the hasting after the physician, the beggar's tramp, the drunkard's stagger, the laughing party of mechanics, the escape youths. Now there's the first of that long list that Whitman puts in that we have encountered together. And if there's one thing that Whitman likes, it's a long list. But I think he visualizes everything, every piece of it. None but are accepted, none but shall be dear to me. And you see, here's another thing. If you were reading Mr. Eliot, T.S. Eliot, you would have to have footnotes and articles on the text in order to know what he's talking about. Whitman, you don't need a thing. Now look at the next one. The air that serves with me with breath to speak. Now you watch, this will catch you. The air, you air, that serves me with breath to speak. You objects that call from diffusion my meanings. And if you tell me his meaning there, I'll pay for the drinks.
Oh.
Now, what are the objects that call from diffusion his meaning? Reception. All right, he uses all the birth, the hastening after the physician, the drunken stagger, in order to tell you that he doesn't deny any of those. He accepts all those. He receives them all. They all exist. Now he says, you objects that call from diffusion my meaning. Those are the objects that call from these diffuse abstract terms his meaning. See how simple it is. Once you sort of get a toehold. Public road, I skip over to 4. I say back, I'm not afraid to leave you, yet I love you. Express me better than I can express myself. Isn't that nice? He can't express himself without the help of this open road, with a public road. Public road. By that, I guess open road means public road. You shall be more to me than any person. I think heroic deeds were all conceived in the open air, and all free poems also. I think I could stop here myself and do miracles. I think whatever I shall meet on the road, I shall like, and whoever beholds me shall like me. I think whoever I see must be happy. One of my neighbors back in the town where I was brought up, my parents' age. Great talker. But they got to be a right wealthy family. And it never went to the head or anything. And you know what they did? She did. After her husband died. She took a bus trip. Clear out to the West Coast and back. That way, she said, she got to see the people. And buses just irritate me to death. I don't have this common touch. But she talked to everybody she saw. And then they went into the sandwich room, and she talked to everybody she saw in there. And she could stop overnight to see and with some of these people she just met and go out and see the Hermitage. And I don't know how much attention they paid to the Hermitage, but they had fine talk. Now this open road and this free talk, and you see, that's what I think about when I see you. You see, I don't want you to just be tense and nervous and talk about adjustment and acceptance and all those things and just consume all the stimulants when there's the open road and the free outside where all heroic deeds are done. And you see, you say, what difference does it make to me? It doesn't matter to me. I don't want to talk about one thing and do another. You say, why don't I live like that? I do try to. I try to. Some of my neighbors, I use this little thing and tapes them. It's not on now. I don't want to hear what I say. I go home and play it, especially people I like. And they have in them a good bit of what Whitman talks about. They talk, and that there is this heroic strain, like in Starbuck and them. And just because you don't see it, or somebody else doesn't see it, doesn't mean it's not there, you see. You may not know what to look for. Now, you see, you let me talk too much. Yeah. What you can do, you see, this will be a sort of an insight, introduction, entrance into John Steinbeck. And I was, you see, that's the thing I told you. We just get started in here in one term. We could stay together for another term and say, go into John Steinbeck and just kind of see it. I think it would just, we just pursue these points. Let me give you a paper. And Moby Cominers are exalted. The men of the whaling profession are well accounted for, and the chapter entitled The Advocate of Ishmael goes into great detail of the defense of the profession as men, even goes to the extreme of comparing them with nobility. Now, you see, that's fine, except it had no content. But on the quiz from the days before, Starbuck, the first mate, is a thinker. He's a man of intelligent conviction. Stubb is a man of conformity, denying his true feelings as when he decides not to go back and take Ahab. He desires no conflict and seeks as much comfort from life as his occupation will allow, as evidenced by his desire for pipes to be close at hand and flash. Now, what I do is put in that same information, but give a little of it, which would show them this is them as commoners. Then give just a little bit, you see, that elevates them. Now that's what I call content. And in this, I follow this little thing from the open road. New objects. I finish that for me. New objects that draw from diffusion my thoughts, meaning. These are the objects that draw from diffusion my meaning. So now, for the first time in here, you have encountered as one of the hindrances to the individual abstractions. It's in the others, but Whitman is the first to make a point of it. You see, your thought needs to be embodied. After class, Darcy came by and said,
that she would come back to the writer's class and talk a little bit. She had said before, you know, when I told her they were more interested in her than they were in the paper, they were interested in both. She didn't think she wanted to stand up front and just expose her soul and account for herself. But I think from this now, as I listen to the tape, as I transfer it from the little machine to the big one, I think she saw in this what she had done in her paper, that she had taken the abstractions about the institutions course and woven them together from passages, and she did that very well, and it was strong, but there wasn't the body. There wasn't the object, you see, to embody the thought. And that's what I think she saw from this. Now, I returned the papers, and I made the mistake of returning the ones that I had marked. And when they gave them back to me, I couldn't put my finger on it, so I fumbled for about 10 minutes. And I never did get it straight. I had it all worked out in good comments on the papers. I just got carried away with Whitman, I guess, so I won't tape all that. As I was just telling Faye, I can see one of the boys who sits on my right, and right on the front row. And he looks at me a little kinder. I was just telling Faye, with this material, I don't see how anybody could escape it, you know, just the great attractiveness of it. But you could see them all over the room from day to day acting a little more kindly towards you, and not as if it's a forced attendance.
This is Wednesday, February 21st, 1968. This is beginning of Wednesday, February 21st.
It takes me a day or two to recover. I wasn't worth anything yesterday. I kept thinking about what we talked about in class on Monday. I'd ever thought of it in those terms, you see, and it just came out of our discussion. Now, I think this approach is certainly safe. And what you see in these writers, you see, is an unfolding. One writer leads to another. If we say that Whitman, or if we can see him in his Broadway jaunts. Oh, just look. Now, let me show you. Just look at those. Let me see if I can find it. What certain actors and singers had a great deal to do with the business all through these years, off and on. I see he didn't go to school. I frequented the old Park, the Bower, Broadway, Chatham Square theaters, and the Italian operas at Chambers Street, Astor Place, and the Battery. And many seasons was on the free list, writing for papers, even as quite a youth. The old Park Theater, what names, reminiscences, the words bring back. Now, all these are famous people in the theater. Placide, Clark, Miss Vernon, Fisher, Clara Fisher, Mrs. Wood, Miss Seguin, Ellen Tree, Hackett, the young Keith, McCready, Miss John. I see in his mind, and then look at the singers. Where are the singers? Fanny Kimball. And I heard in these years, well rendered, all the Italian and other operas in vogue. I won't pronounce, won't try to pronounce all those foreign names. And he saw, he had in his mind, you see, just pictures of Fanny Kimball in those plays. and he'd see them again and again. Now that's, I'd say, now look, if that is a sort of development and a kind of a fulfillment of what Emerson and Thoreau are talking about and do, now just read that back into Thoreau. And then to say, you know, that Thoreau goes to Walden to withdraw. Now, isn't that amazing? How one writer sheds light on the others? I think it is. Now, you don't like to remember your old position. You think it shows up that where you're wrong. I don't feel that way about it in about myself. I try to take those old positions along with me because they put into focus, you see, any new positions that I take. I just assume that my first reading, you see, all along will be sort of a process. I'll be getting ideas and discarding them. Any reader, Custer, thinks of Thoreau as withdrawing from society and other occupations in order to do what? Now that's a question, to do what? And I don't think any amount of discussing will quite work that out. Now I would say this to you, you see, that Thoreau himself has too much vigor to withdraw from anything. He's not trying to escape anything. He has to confront things. I mean, I would just, you know, just abstractly argue that way, theoretically. And don't you know, when we were talking about Franklin as a public man, and then Thoreau, you see, was not a public man by choice. And still, the little thing that goes underneath the title is, he is going to crow like Chanticleer, if for no other reason, to wake up his neighbors. So that he may be as much a public man, even though he didn't help draft the Constitution. It's hard to say, you know, what is it Thoreau went for? What are you going to say? Yes. Now, Thoreau is sensitive like Whitman and responds to the landscape. Would you say that would be his chief object as well, to respond to the landscape?
No, but I'm just saying that as far as
get it into a corner and examine it. And if it was cheap, still make the most of it. But still, in Walden, we don't quite see him facing up to things, facing things. Now, you talk a little bit more. That in Whitman, that he does elevate the common, and all these little things he sees out on the open road, all those, even the diseased people. It's a lesson of, what do you call it, reception. You see that, would you say, more in Whitman than in Emerson? I think you do. I know you see it more in Whitman, and I think actually it's stronger in Whitman. I don't think Emerson has gone as far as Whitman. I think that's the way it worked. But now you don't see that in Thoreau. Thoreau, he did all those things. He raised beans, and he observed things around Walden Pond, and it was important to him. And as he tells it, it seems important to us. But it's nothing quite like Whitman, would you say? Well, I think we've opened it up. Here, now to her own self, Hester Prynne remained true. She alone in the novel dared renounce utterly the dead forms of tradition and dared follow the natural laws of her own instinctive nature. For Hester, as it's quoted, the world's law was no law for her, her mind. She seemed to renounce traditional morality and to proclaim the new morality. Now, let me ask you, do you know exactly what she does deny and then proclaim? I wouldn't use morality, the term. The point here, now, I'm not taking issue with the point here. I'm thinking mostly about the term. Think Hawthorne ever fills that out. Does that occur to you? Maybe it's not to his purpose to fill it out. Now, how would you fill it out? You can do it. My thinking now is about how to work out your points. And I would do it on your papers, just like I try to do it in here. You see what I did with you last time. We just worked into that. Just by analogy from Whitman, I can see much more clearly what Thoreau did. And in Hester, where Emerson Hawthorne doesn't fill it out, I can kind of fill it out. Now, it seems to me that there is a statement of the point here. But then it's diverted into this business about the law of her own nature, you see, and that gets into the same old question, you see, of sin and guilt. And I don't think that's in the scholar's letter, unless you just want to take those two passages. Now look, I don't think you have time to work out the Emersonian viewpoint, the whole thing. Now, here is a page or two on it, and it's good. Emerson's view can be analyzed in terms of opposites also, as he discussed such things as conformity. And what you think, what other people think, and first thoughts and second thoughts, and the flash of insight that comes to the mind. Now, you see, that means you've got over three pages, and your paper, you see, has still not started. Now let me give you another illustration. Here it says of Hester, Hester expresses self-reliance. She is strong. Now, this will work out. She is a strong, determined woman who accepts her fate and lives on. She exerts skill in her needlework. She's not a Puritan, but represents a lady of the Renaissance. Her dress is plain, yet she dresses pearl in high fashion. She had a taste for beauty, her relationship to the poor. Now, what I'm trying to say is, how will you avoid those separate, isolated, scattered remarks about Hester or about any of them? Now, that's a thinking problem, but it's a writing problem, and it comes out in your writing and your test. To me, it's very simple, because I've worked in this a good bit, and I have found that a person can actually learn more about handling a subject from a class like this than he can in an out-and-out writing class. I'd say just give me a man who'll write a sentence and read just a little bit. Now, you see, you don't realize that. I'm working with you. I'm going to get to Whitman in just a minute. And, you see, I've done this with, I've worked with all sorts of people, some of the first-rate minds I've worked with on just such terms as I'm working with you on now, so I hope you won't think it's patronizing. And I find that it's almost impossible for a student, cluttered as his mind has to be in the curriculum now, to think anything out really very clearly. I've worked with a large number of outstanding students here and in other places. And in material like this, I say to you, they have found out more about the world they live in, about how to handle material than have anywhere else. Now, I'm not saying that experimentally to you. I'm saying that I have done that for years. And all that I need is just for you to be receptive. I don't ask you to do everything I say, you understand that? And I haven't laid down any system of beliefs for you. I've hardly told you a thing to believe, hardly a thing. But I'm talking to you now about an approach. It'd be a very simple thing to remedy the fault that I spoke to you about on this paper. And it's more or less on all of the papers. It just has to be. You look at Hester, now you watch. Now you watch. I do this with you from day to day. That's what I hate for you to miss, you see. I want you to see these things. Now this is just a little miracle. It just takes place right before your eyes, and you won't believe it, you see. You won't open your mind to it. Now, you see, I'm talking to you right confidentially. Hester, as she said, is not a Puritan. She is, as we said, just taking over that familiar figure, Portia, akin to the great lady of the Renaissance. She has a magnanimity. That's one of their qualities. There is what Hawthorne calls a voluptuous. Is that the word? Voluptuous quality. I don't know. I can't get it. She's a woman of passion, passion. Now, that's not passion in our sense. But the first picture of Hester is Hester as a great lady in Emerson's sense. She is exalted through action. And it's not sin and guilt. Now, you see, why don't anyone recognize that? You tell me. I don't know. That's all I'd say through the whole paper. I'd say Hester is a person in the Emersonian sense in that she is large. In this first view, in the second view, and at the end, it's her mind that's large. She herself has been emancipated from all these petty, petty pressures of the society. The pettiness of society. And her mind is large, you see. Now look, don't stop with Hester, but say you get that view in a number of other portraits. Dimmesdale has to be large in spirit. He can't stand up before the whole Puritan Commonwealth, you see, on that one important day of the year, and carry forth with such eloquence. He's not weak. Now there's that Emersonian man. It's also Thoreau. Now that's all I'm saying to you. Don't try to cover all of Emerson and work out his beliefs, except in a rather cursory way, but pick out one of them, or one factor in that Emersonian personality, and then see that in what the character does. Now, you know what that will do. You see, you inevitably have to be nervous about the things you put on. They're all, even though the instructor tells you, you know, he regards what you say as important, he still has to grade what you say. You see, there's always that little feeling of desire for approval. Now, that's inevitable. Good Lord, I've done it so much. And when I come in here, I have that same feeling, you see. I can't come in here and talk against you. We have to sort of hit it off together. I mean, I have that same, we all have that same, same hesitancy. But now look what this will do. I have had fine, gifted, intelligent students with a fine background tell me that people nowadays are nervous. And their papers are going to be nervous. That's not right. That is simply not right. One little insight resolves that nervousness. One little feeling of control. And you see, all these writers have it. Thoreau has immense control. Hawthorne is the great artist so far. He's really the only artist until you get to Emily Dickinson. You see, he's not nervous, and you won't be nervous. And he'll give you a little sweep. You won't be just picking out little things, you see. You'll get something that's large and carry it through. Oh, about a little thing. Well, now, you see, you're going to tell me to go back and take care of my cattle, that I've talked too much. Dimmesdale does that, too. Now, what I wanted to do from these papers, I was going to talk about a whole lot more of them because I'm interested in them. I went through your papers and marked them. You can't read my writing, but I looked at them closely. Now, I'm going to give them back to you, but I don't want you to keep them. I want you to let me have them in a day or two. And I've got, you let me have one batch, and I want to sit down. I want to go through them and pick out passages and type it out a little more fully, where I can get your positions as you first read these things. That interests me greatly. It's all, you see, a process of going towards the light and leaving the darkness behind. And you know, when I go home, I can't remember that. I can't say, now here are the things that we had to discard as we went through all this material. I can't remember it. Now, I just want to sit down and just pick out some of those things. You see, you write on sin and guilt with great amount of intellect. But as Milton says about Satan, it's misguided intellect. That makes it sophistry. Well, you say, that's right. Now, you see these things. I'm not trying to put anything over on you. And I think these papers will mean a great deal to you. Now, let me tell you what I wanted to do. I wanted, in a day or two, the first of the week or the middle of the week, next week, I want to give you an objective test, not a writing test, I mean not a essay, but an objective test. And I don't want you to prepare for that any more than you'd normally prepare for what you do in here. I want to ask you about some of these things on Whitman, maybe some new things, mostly some of the things I have brought up for you. I want to bring up a thing or two in Emerson, but you don't have to go back and reread Emerson for that. I just want to give you a chance to set it down clearly, and face it yourself, that's all. You don't have to be emotional about it at all. It's not going to hurt you. That'll help me and also help you. Now, let me tell you. On the open road, let me talk to you just a minute about the open road. Now, I won't go into it. You can go into it. Now, you look. Say, I think heroic deeds. That's the last thing we said. Now, how does that impress you? Just take your time and look at it. I think heroic deeds all take place out in the open. And if you want to say anything that Emerson said, you know, it's not true. I don't know what it is. It's true enough for me. Or whatever sense it's true. Now look, I inhale, then on the next in the next one. From this hour, I ordain myself loosed of limits and imaginary lines, going where I list, my own master, total and absolute, listening to others, considering well what they say, pausing, searching, receiving, contemplating gently, but with undeniable will, and divesting myself of the hold, you see, that would hold me. Now, that's what all of them have done, Hester and all of them. I inhale great drafts of space. I think that's marvelous. I am larger, better than I thought. All seems beautiful to me. Now, you say that he denies evil. Well, what are you going to do? You want to hop on that? He doesn't make a great deal of evil. Are you going to say, well, here's a man who doesn't think there's evil. I'll show him a little. He gets to the evil, and you find him. He'll get to it later, and we'll see. Now look in that next one, number six. Now I see the secret of making the best persons. It's to grow in the open air and to eat and sleep with the earth. Now he's polemic. He's argumentative, like Thoreau. Now here's a test of wisdom, if you want it. Wisdom's not tested in schools. Wisdom can't be passed from one person to another who doesn't have it, you see. Wisdom's of the soul, not susceptible of proof. It's his own proof. Now he never tells you that, what wisdom is, but he's just sparring. I don't particularly care for those parts like that in wisdom. But it doesn't, I guess, all right. Now, look at number seven. Here is the efflux of the soul. Now, that's his word, and it has no meaning. The efflux of the soul comes from within through embowered gates, ever-provoking questions. These yearnings, why are they? These thoughts in the darkness, why are they? Now, I would say from just this little bit, you see, that he recognizes doubt. In the dark, these suspicions that come to him, you see. Now, he uses the same thing, number eight. And number nine, now this is the part I think is not very much like Whistler. He uses that French word, allons, but he doesn't pronounce it that way. You know how he pronounces it? Allons! He'll anglicize it. He's not afraid of it, you see. It's ignorant, isn't it? Allons, he says, and then he says it over and over again. Allons, whoever you are, come travel with me. Allons, the inducement. He says, here we are, let's go. Don't just stand here. Traveling with me, you find what never tires. The earth is rude, silent, incomprehensible at first. And you see, we convinced by our presence. That's the last line of number 10. And whenever he talks about presence, you've got to remember, this is one of the scenes that sort of stuck in my mind. In his later years, he was out west with President Grant, and he met some of the Indians. And the Indians came up to meet them and to transact some business. And they came up to Whitman. They thought he looked like the president.
And he did, you see. He was a presence. So he knows just from his own experience what that is. Listen, in number 11, I will be honest with you. I don't offer you the old smooth prizes, but offer rough new prizes. I have a little meeting there is, you see, has to have a few prizes. And his are going to be different. And in number 12, Alon's After the Great Companion. I don't know. I think that has this kind of a universal appeal, the great companion. What sort of companions does one look for? Companions to get off and whimper with, and complain with, and express doubts with, and talk about the inequities of the system, and these terrible sea courses. That's what he's talking about. I think there is an Emersonian approach. I use that in a rather general term, in a rather general way. Even in the University College, I better keep out of present politics, so I yes. Pauses and contemplators, you see. To see no possession, but you may possess it, enjoying all without labor or purchase. Now, you see, he's picking up that same thing that Franklin and Thoreau picked up, property. That's it there. Behold, through you, as bad as the rest, through the laughter, dancing, and all, and the lawns, the road is before us. It is safe. I have tried it. My own feet have tried it. And you see, you can follow him. Now, let me work with you just a minute on the one I talked to said. Now, where is that? My old paper here about preface, 1855. Now let me show you something. You know the American Scholar. You remember how it starts? Preface 1855. You know how it starts? The American Scholar. You remember that? Remember that? Oh, I can't just say it all. But he says the present has actions now that must be sung. I can't say it. It's a sort of an affirmation of the present. And we no longer can sing the old feudal songs, he says. And for that reason, you know, in time he'll attack Shakespeare. But now look at here. Look at Whitman. It's almost the same, almost paraphrased. America does not deny the past or what the past has produced under its form, or amid other politics, or the idea of caste, or the old...